Live under protectors, Chris. Welcome to the show, brother.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jason. Appreciate it.
You know, we always talk about, you know, us older folks about technologically impairment, technologically impaired. That's what we are. And trying to get everything down, like iPhones and recording and schedules. Everything is on a computer or your phone now, man. But we've linked up and we're good to go now.
Sounds good.
Let's talk about you. Obviously, because we're on a protector, is talking about you. But, you know, one thing about you is you've had like such a varied background that put you in the spotlight of a lot of like really big things in your career. Especially going from, you know, NYPD to then bam, you're in Iraq, which is a little bit different than, you know, the streets of New York, if I could say so myself.
Yeah, quite different. Quite different. Yeah.
Let's talk about your career in the PD, man. Why become a cop? Was it kind of like the post-military thing to do?
You know, it was actually pretty much just as you say. It was like a natural transition. You know, the structure, you know, definitely steady paycheck. You know, and if you like hunting the bad guy, you know, that's where you want to be. If you like helping people, that's where you want to be. And, you know, whether it's the NYPD or any police department, you know, it's just something that people have a misconception that, oh, they want to go in there so they can tell people what to do. But really, that's very far from the truth. It's more about, you know, serving, and it is more about helping people and getting involved in interesting cases and investigations and using your mind to solve problems. So
it's about servant leadership, man. It's about being a leader within that community. And it's not just about the power. And if you join the job for a badge and a gun, then you were just leave. We don't want your type in there. If you want just a shield to keep you out of trouble or doing whatever you're doing, leave. Being a policeman, being in any civil servant job, public servant job, is about service. So yes, brother, that's why a logical choice for a lot of us when we leave the military is joining the PD or joining some other servant.
Absolutely. I mean, I did 4 years in the Marine Corps, and you know, it's funny. I talked to quite a few friends now because of Facebook and technology, and we ended up having a reunion some years ago, probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And the majority of the guys that I was with in HMA 269 in New River made a career out of it. I was one of maybe about 4 or 5 other people that got out, but the rest of the guys seemed to have stayed and went on to be warrant officers and majors. And one was actually on the list for to be Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, a friend of mine from Staten Island, this fellow Paul. So it is interesting that, you know, I did leave, but then I went right, as you say, right into the police department. I needed something a little bit different. But for a lot of the guys that I work with, they stayed. They loved it. They enjoyed it very much.
It's being mission oriented as well. You know, that's why a lot, you know, law enforcement and fire departments, anything, you need a mission, man. When you get out of the service, your mission's over with. That service, whether it's 4 years, 20 years, 25 years, or whatever, is just really a bookmark in your life. But you still always need a mission. And that mission for you was, hey, you know what? Join a PD. And then from there, it's like, hey, you know what? I like being on the street, but you know what? I want to do more. I want to put the piece of the puzzle together. That's kind of like me. I did a Border Patrol uniform. And then I was like, hey, you know what? I want to be a special agent. It's in the federal system, but then I get put puzzle pieces together and look at the bigger picture. Let's talk about your time as a detective, man, in NYPD, right?
Yeah, I was actually a sergeant in the intelligence division the last 5 years. So funny story, I really didn't want to go. I was actually doing what they call street narcotics enforcement in the 76th precinct in Brooklyn. And I was surrounded by some really amazing people, fun people, all different backgrounds, races, ethnicities. And we just had fun. And we locked up a lot of people. And we banged down a lot of doors doing search warrants. And then 9/11 had happened. And the captain had approached me and asked me to take this position, what they call the field intelligence officer. And I really didn't want to go. Like I said, I was having too much fun where I was. And my son had gotten sick. And this same captain that had asked me to take this job had gotten me off work for 8 weeks full pay. So when it came time to return the favor, and it wasn't like it was an obligation, I could have still said no, but I was like, how can I say no to this guy? I mean, I was home with my son while he was recovering from a very serious illness. So it turned out to be probably the best decision I almost didn't make, because once I got in there, I was surrounded by some really gifted people, some super smart people. And I had a crew of, at one point, 8 detectives, and they made me look like a superstar. And now I'm doing counterterrorist investigations, which I didn't know anything about. I mean, I knew the street. I was a street guy for 13 years. I did plain clothes for 12 of the 13 years. And now the last 5, I'm in, I'm wearing not so much a suit and tie, but business casual. And I'm like doing a lot of door knocking, a lot of surveillance, a lot of intensive investigations. And there was a learning curve initially. So, well,
but the thing is, I got to stop you right there, man, is because narcotics, and a lot of people that never worked the narco world and narcotics, you learn so much about human intelligence. You learn so much about human sources. And I'm getting at something when it comes to humans. You get so much comfortable talking to people that aren't particularly your demographic, i.e. they're criminals, you're not. And the other thing too, is you get used to danger, things from going from 0 to 1,000 in a split second. Nothing happens. You can't put people behind bars, bad people, by sitting behind a computer. So you, it's almost like a natural progression to get into a terrorism, a counterterrorism type role post 9/11, because they need people that have street smarts and they need people that could talk to people. And that means communicating that to the people you're working with. So yeah, brother, go ahead. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I thank you. You start doing intelligence work, and there's a lot of things that are nuanced in the intelligence. Like, to your point, you get used to working with sources and you get used to working with criminal informants and things like that. But in the counterterrorism realm, you know, in the beginning, I wasn't very good at connecting the dots in terms of what is actually terrorism or what could potentially have a nexus to terrorism. And now, you know, like I said, being surrounded by some smart people, I learned very quickly. And then what also comes into play quite often is the Patriot Act, which keeps evolving and changing as we move along. But, you know, things that you couldn't actually do on a criminal side, if it fell within the parameters of the Patriot Act, now you could detain people, which is different and separate and apart from arresting people. So if I could actually determine that somebody was involved in something that might be terrorist related, I could, you know, drop them right there and then and start conducting an investigation and detain them until I could prove otherwise, rule them in or rule them out. Whereas, you know, when it's criminal, it's either you have probable cause to make an arrest or you got to dust the guy off and let him go. And believe me, the intelligence division in the NYPD, if anybody had any real awareness of what goes on there on a daily basis, they would fall out of their chair. It's unbelievable. It's monumental in terms of what you were saying before, human intelligence, which is separate and apart from electronic intelligence or surveillance. You know, you door knock and you talk to people, you know, the database that, you know, the NYPD has is so coveted. It is really the Google repository for all things human intelligence worldwide, not just nationally, worldwide. Some of the other things that maybe your people that listen to your podcast may not be aware of is what we have is foreign service officers in every major city around the world. So there is an active duty NYPD detective and a sergeant, and sometimes 2 of each, depending on the threat level for the city and the geography and the demographics of it all around the world, reporting in real time on the ground at the scene, funneling it back to the fusion cell in lower Manhattan. So there's no more delay in an event that happens in London or Paris or, you know, in Saudi Arabia or Jerusalem. It's coming in real time because there is a real NYPD intelligence officer attached to the hip of the host nation's intelligence officer. And we're getting it in real time, not a watered down version of what people want to do, you know, on the news broadcast. This is the real, you know, granular stuff that you need to keep New York City and other cities in the United States safe.
I love it, man. I love intelligence, man. You know, in the military, I was an artillery dude, combat arms. I branched infantry later on. For a few years there, I did human intelligence with the Guard in Minnesota. I loved it. But my wife was an interrogator in the 90s, and then she became an MI officer, and then went to Bureau and did Human later on after she worked fraud. But it's like, I love intel, man. And I love, I don't know why I never just branched. I guess I just always had that, I want to be combat arms type dude. But I love intelligence, man. And the more you get into law enforcement, and the more you get either in the detective realm, the sergeant realm, or in any type of leadership, you understand and you grasp that you need data, whether that's human data, signals data, or any other type of data in order to really get to where you need to be. As a sergeant, you need data in order for your people to work, to go down and put the pieces of the puzzle together, whether or not it's taking an interview you had over here, link that up with a phone number over here, an email over here, or anything, putting this big matrix, this big puzzle. And once you learn that it's all this, you really, that excitement level just goes boom. First 4 or 5 years, you're on the street, you're knocking down doors, you're doing this, you're doing that. After a while, you're kind of like, maybe I want to kind of move up to here and put the real bad people away. So you do the PD, man. You're like, hey, cool. You retire, and then you go on to work with the DOD and those other OGA type things, or did you finish out your career with the NYPD?
Yeah, I retired. I retired as a sergeant at the intelligence division. Had a beautiful going away party, retirement party, got the ring and all the other good things. And you know, my plan was at the time to retire to Roanoke, Virginia, and do construction. And that lasted for about 9 months. The guy I was working with, we didn't see eye to eye. I'm sure he didn't like the way I was conducting business, but we just couldn't get along. And now I'm kind of like unemployed. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? And when you have this in you, you know, when I say chasing the bad guy or, you know, helping people, everything else is ordinary after that. It really is. And if you are an adrenaline junkie, and I had become addicted to the adrenaline, mm-hmm. It's hard to just put that away. And I had applied for a job with MPRI L3 Communications, and I get a phone call, and the guy says, you know, I'm reading over your resume, and we think you'd be a good fit for this. Is this something you'd be interested in? It's going to require a 1-year commitment. So I come to find out later that it was actually a JIATO project, which stands for the Joint Improvised Explosive Device Defeat Organization. And basically what we were going to be doing was, applying traditional law enforcement in a war zone and tracking terrorists and putting them down, basically.
Yeah, you know, when you bring that up, it's like, so I was there in 05, 06 Iraq, and that's when they really started pinging, like, I was attached to the Special Forces dudes as their anti-terrorism guy, staffer. But one thing we found out was they were tasking anybody who had law enforcement experience within the SF community. It's like, hey, you know what? When you go and you roll up an IED maker or labs or anything else, collect evidence. And I'd imagine that's where JIATO came in. It was like, hey, you know what? All that evidence you're getting, fingerprints, data, means opportunity, intent type things. The law enforcement world really does help figure out these networks, man.
Well, yeah, absolutely. To your point, you're asking a 19-year-old kid to do the job of a 20-year veteran of any police department. But I'm from the NYPD, and I'm just saying that as an example. You can't get the same result. It's a level of experience. It's a level of maturity. There's all kinds of nuances, and you could send these kids to all the schools in the world. Again, it's all academic until it's actually yep. applied. And the stress level, as you know, having been in a war zone, adds to, you know, the complications. So, you know, I've been there, done this in terms of being surrounded by high adrenaline and danger and tense situations. And I'm always afraid. I mean, there's always a level of fear, but management becomes a little bit easier, how to manage that and cope with that. When you're thousands of miles away from home, away from your family, you know, you got some, like, again, going back, you have a 19-year-old kid, the expectation is unrealistic. It's unattainable for them, for somebody that age, to do the same type of job that a 20-year veteran has been doing, you know, all along.
I'm glad, you know, I'm really glad you bring that up too, is because just because you have a schooling or education behind you doesn't make you interchangeable with, so let's say policing. You got a guy who's five, 6 years on a job. They know a lot more than someone who just came out of the academy. But in the overall scheme of things, people that have never lived outside their little bubble don't realize you can't just rehire someone out of the academy to take the skill set of someone that has 5-6 years on a job, or like you, 20 something years. That's why you do need contractors. That's why you do need people with experience. You can't just take a 19-year-old who's only seen action movies and academia and make them interchangeable. It's not the reality. And I wish more people realize that that is in any job. It's not a reality.
Yeah, correct. I mean, you know, here again, you know, going back to the intelligence division and even the narcotics, you know, I was surrounded by some really gifted interrogators and people that did interviews. So now, you know, my job for this project over in Iraq, which lasted 15 months, you know, I learned from the best. So I don't say I'm the best, but I was definitely around some of the best people in the world. And, you know, it's like interview and interrogation, you know, for people that aren't aware of it, it's a perishable skill. It's a lot like playing any kind of a sport. You know, yeah, the basics and the foundation are there, but if you don't do it with any kind of degree of frequency, you're rusty. And then when you get in the box, you know, you're not as comfortable and as confident as you should be. You know, for me, I wasn't that far removed. So it was still fresh. And I had a burning desire to really take it to these people that were killing our brothers and sisters over there, because that really made me angry and frustrated watching it. So the vested interest, the level of commitment, you know, it was just, again, a change in location, but the venue. But the actors, the implementation, all very much the same. All very much the same.
I'm so glad you said that. Interview and interrogation is a skill, and it's a perishable skill, and you need to really keep on top of it. You know, the thing too is cultural norms. Having access to such a diverse community that you're policing in New York has to help when you go overseas and you're sitting across from a Shia or a Sunni or anybody and learning their cultural norms, because you know what? It's another thing that's perishable. You have to know who you're talking to. Because the person on the other side of that table, they can see through bullshit. And as soon as they see through the bullshit, you're over. So
done.
What was it like that first time you actually sat across from someone completely different than, you know, being in New York or being in your quote unquote comfort zone?
Well, you know, I had the benefit of having American translators, but they were their origins were Arab. So one of the translators I had was a Syrian American of Syrian descent. So, you know, when you have the benefit of somebody who's actually grown up in Syria and is now fluent in both language, you know, you get a lot of that cultural advantage in terms of what's right, what's wrong. But a big thing, what you just said, which would be good to point out to your audience, one of the biggest advantages I've had, aside from all the training and interviews and interrogation I had done in New York, was my age. I was 48 years of age. Now, you know, but maybe your people in your audience don't know, when you're talking to an Arab man, if you're younger than him and you're barking at him, that doesn't go over well. They shut down, like you say, they smell the BS and they're like, I'm not talking to you because you're insulting me. You're not even of the same age and awareness of what's going on in the world. You're a kid. And again, that's what was happening a lot with the soldiers over there. They're having some young kid talk to a 45-year-old guy who, by the way, as you probably also know, and your audience may not know, has a master's degree in engineering. He could be a doctor. He could be a lawyer. And now, because, you know, there's a power shift in Iraq, they're suddenly unemployed. So now they're part of a cell building bombs and getting paid. So all those different things, you know, I'm coming back now to the interpreter and cultural awareness. I had the benefit of having one who was a Syrian fellow, and the other one was an Egyptian soldier. He was actually in the U.S. Army for like 6 years active duty. And now he was on the same project as me. And he was a little bit younger than me. I think I was, at the time I was 48. I think he was probably 41, 42. But again, big difference when you have, you know, two adults, so to speak. And the, you know, for the most part, most of the people I was talking to were younger than me in terms of being bad guys and insurgents.
It's crazy, the cultural norms. And you threw something else out there, money. Money, money, money. A lot of people, my audience maybe probably knows, some of them, a lot of these IED factories, makers out there were doing it for money. It wasn't ideology, it was money. in a lot of ways, you track people's money. And you, if when you throw that ideology out there and you look at it for what it is, crime, it's a lot different, brother. And, you know, money, man, it's a true root of some of this evil out there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, again, they're, like you say, some are warped by ideology, you know, for the cause and kill the infidels, and the others are just doing it for money. But it's interesting that you brought up the fact about money. Now, you know, a lot of these raids that we went on, we would recover U.S. currency and lots of $10,000 in 100 U.S. dollar bills, $100 bills in serial number order. Now, I don't know where the money came from, but I can tell you right now, they didn't steal it. Okay. Somebody gave it to them. So when you start doing the interrogation of this person and you combine the forensic evidence that's at this person's house or the building that you've captured them at, along with the money and along with some commander's coins and things like that, and some memorandum from, you know, different headquarters here and there, that's very problematic. So basically what's happening is the team that I was a part of was so successful. We rounded up 91 high value targets, tier one and tier two. No BS in that statement. Clear proof of all of that. And what's happening now is we're finding these people and we're finding this money. And from time to time, the base commander would just shut us down, because now that's getting briefed back at the COIC over in Reston. And that's going to eventually make it to the president's desk for his daily insum. And they're going to want to know, how is this possible and whose money was this? And again, I'm not the internal affairs of the Army or the military. I don't really care. But it seems to me that somebody should care more about it than me, because I'm finding it. And these people are directly responsible for killing our brothers and sisters over there.
Yeah. And that's where it comes down to accountability. Because, you know, just as I do, that money was getting tossed around in the bucket loads, the pallet loads out there trying to win the hearts and minds. It doesn't work. That same money was obviously being used for other means. And nobody wants to be accountable.
No. You know?
And when it, no. That old adage of servant leadership, a lot of times it doesn't make it to the higher ranks, and they're all about their own little kingdoms and fiefdoms and working their way up. And it comes out that, hey, maybe they didn't do the right thing and they didn't step up. Yeah, that's, some careers are going to get lost. It's unfortunate that good people out there doing great things get shuffled to the side, man.
Well, you know, who knew there'd be politics involved in the military? You know what I mean? When you're in 06 and you're just dying, yeah, to be in 07 and on. And I get that. Listen, we all have pride and ego. We all want, you know, good things in our life. We all want to advance, but not at the expense of my brothers and sisters. I'm sorry. That's where I draw the line. I'm sorry. And again, I mean, I could go on and on. You've been there. We've both been there. We know, we've seen it. It's not my imagination.
It's not,
you know, it's terribly frustrating, because you know that you're out there, you know, listen, I've worked beyond the point of exhaustion, 35, 46, 48 hours straight, where I watched the sunrise twice after coming back from an 8-hour op, you know, processing, writing the human intelligence reports, the interrogation reports, processing all the evidence. And then you say to yourself, for what? Like, it seems like I care more about the project than the owner of the project, which, yeah, that they'll never change me inside. That would never, like, I don't care what they do. Like, I care to the extent that it's disappointing and it's sad and it's frustrating, but that's not going to make me say, well, you know what, throw my hands up. I'm not going to go out there and do the best job I can, or anyone on the team for that matter. But it is a frustrating thing. And it is a horrible thing to watch in front of you, because before I was there, I was very naive. I have to be honest with you, Jason. I thought, there's no way something like that could possibly happen. Like, that would only be in a movie. But it turns out it's not really just only in a movie.
That's the other reason I always wanted to have you on, and we finally linked up our schedules, because some of the shit we've seen over our careers these past 20 something years is it's amazing. It is absolutely amazing. And that's why I really, you know what, like I told you, I'm about 60 pages into your book. I like it. It's good. It's not written like a fluff piece. It's like solid, man. And I'm going to finish it if I could sit down and actually have some time to read the book, Brooklyn of Baghdad, an NYPD intelligence cop fights terror in Iraq. Christopher Strom with Jeremy Pressler and Michael Benson. Got to get it, people. You got to get it. Because, you know, you're going to talk about a lot of things that I talk about, too, is when you get to the I know you are. I could read it in his books. When you get to these areas, you think this shit really can't be happening. But it is. It really is. That's why I'm telling you, buy this book. Because that same shit that's happening back then is happening now, and we could fix it. Got to get the conversation out there, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without question. It can be done better. It can be done better. And there's no reason for it not to be done better.
Well, Christopher, the cool thing is that I'd like to have you back on the show, co-host. And then afterwards, after I read the book, we'll have you on again. But I definitely want to have you back on the show, brother.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. Thank you so much, Jason. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks.